Chapter 17. Deep State Players. Epstein's lesser-known associates. As the flight logs of his planes and the numbers in the little black book attest, Epstein's circle of influence was vast and included some of the most prominent figures in politics, science, technology, finance, and popular culture. Some of his relationships have been recorded in this audiobook and have been widely reported in the press, but so much is yet unknown. And to document all of Epstein's many links would take several volumes. This chapter aims to take a closer look at a handful of his acquaintances who have so far remained unexplored in this audiobook and have largely escaped the kind of media scrutiny reserved for the likes of Prince Andrew, Donald Trump, Bill Clinton, and others. Indyk and Khan. No one, it seems, is more mired in the business dealings of Jeffrey Epstein than the two co-executors of his will. Darren Indyk, his long-term attorney, and Richard Khan, his accountant. Indyk, now in his 50s, worked for Epstein from 1995, according to public records dug up in an investigation by Yahoo Finance. Epstein, it appears, was Indyk's biggest client during those 25 years. Indeed, the Yahoo report could find no clients of Indyk's who weren't Epstein or associates of Epstein. And, as well as having his name appear on numerous charitable filings, real estate records and trademark filings, Indyk was also listed as the treasurer and vice president of three of Epstein's charities: the COUQ Foundation, Gratitude America Limited, and J. Epstein Virgin Islands Foundation. It is interesting to note that 1995 was the beginning of Indyk and Epstein's official working relationship, because this was the same year that Epstein's financial partner, Stephen Hoffenberg, pleaded guilty to fraud for the Towers financial Ponzi scheme which Epstein was deeply involved in. Indeed, Indyk and his fellow co-executor, Richard Khan, were key players in helping Epstein evade justice over the Towers financial affair, according to Hoffenberg. Hoffenberg told the authors of the book Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales, that the trustee brought in to oversee Towers' financial bankruptcy, Alan Cohen, appointed Indyk and Khan to investigate Epstein's activities at the stricken company. Unsurprisingly, given the relationship between Epstein and Indyk and Khan, Epstein was cleared of all wrongdoing and walked away from the second largest Ponzi scheme in US history, scot-free. Not only that, according to Hoffenberg, but Epstein even got to keep the profits he had made, using them to fund three of his fledgling companies, while Hoffenberg was sentenced to 20 years in prison. This, it seems, was the beginning of a beautiful relationship between Indyk, Khan, and Epstein. The association continued through the noughties, and during Epstein's Florida jail sentence, Indyk visited him no fewer than 38 times, including his very first day of imprisonment. Part of Epstein's plea deal was an incredibly lenient work release agreement which allowed him to be outside of jail at a place of work for up to 12 hours a day. It was Indyk's name that was on this agreement. According to the filings, Indyk was acting as Epstein's employer at the Florida Science Foundation, a non-profit organization that Indyk had set up solely for this purpose. It was created the day after Epstein signed the non-prosecution agreement that included the work release scheme. Epstein used the Florida Science Foundation to make payments totaling $128,000 to the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office between 2008 and 2009. And these weren't the only questionable payments Indyk was in charge of. In his role as treasurer to Epstein's New York state-based COUQ Foundation, Indyke oversaw donations to multiple educational and research organizations that included the Clinton Foundation and Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, according to the Yahoo investigation. Indyke was also the treasurer for Epstein's non-profit Gratitude America Limited, which received a $10 million donation from billionaire investor Leon Black, a man who, over the years, donated more than $150 million to Epstein's various organizations. Then there was Indyke's work for Epstein's inner circle. Indyke's name appears as a trustee for Ghislaine Maxwell's non-profit, the Max Foundation. And according to the Yahoo report, Indyke helped Maxwell buy her New York townhouse at 116 East 65th Street in 2000. Indyke was also listed as secretary for the Wexner Foundation in the 1998 SEC report. And Wexner's wife, Abigail, gave Indyke power of attorney over her 15 Central Park West property. Indyke seems to have had direct ties to the seedier side of Epstein's operations as well. Leslie Groff, one of Epstein's long-term personal assistants and procurer of underage girls, described herself as an executive assistant at DKI PLLC on her LinkedIn profile, according to Yahoo. DKI PLLC is listed in public records as the name of Indyke's law practice, with an office address that doesn't exist. Indyke's real office seems to have been 301 East 66th Street, for nearly a decade at least, an address which might sound familiar, as it's the building owned by Epstein's brother Mark, which was used to house dozens of Epstein's young victims and was much visited by Ehud Barak. As for Khan, not only did he work with Indyke on the Towers financial investigation and is co-executor of Epstein's will, he was also seen sneaking into Epstein's Manhattan townhouse on the day after the paedophile's death. According to the Daily Mail, who photographed Khan entering and leaving the property, he was inside for around 45 minutes and left carrying a blue shopping bag filled with items. Could this have been incriminating information on Epstein's rich and famous blackmail victims? We can only speculate, as Indyke and Khan, as executors of Epstein's estate, have so far refused to hand them over. So what have Indyke and Khan been up to since Epstein's death? As co-executors of his estate, they each stand to receive $250,000 from his will. Apart from that, they have mostly been spending their time hampering investigations into Epstein's crimes and refusing to release important information. Sigrid McCrawley, an attorney representing three of Epstein's victims, told the press that Indyke and Khan had not released a single document that she had requested and called the pair's behaviour obstructionist conduct. Indyke and Khan are estimated to be sitting on no fewer than 730,000 documents pertaining to Epstein's activity. The Attorney General of the US Virgin Islands, Denise George, has brought a civil lawsuit against the Epstein estate for racketeering, which named Indyke and Khan as co-conspirators. George called the Epstein estate an ongoing criminal enterprise, which doesn't sound far wrong. Mark Epstein. Mark Epstein, Jeffrey's younger brother by 2 years, is the sole beneficiary of his estate. He was also one of the first and loudest to cry foul play when Epstein died. Mark was insistent that Epstein had not committed suicide and even hired a second expert to observe the autopsy. Given his close ties to his brother and his challenging of the official narrative around Epstein's death, you might think Mark was up to his eyeballs in the same nefarious games as Epstein. However, perhaps unsurprisingly, Mark Epstein denies having any business ties to his brother. Perhaps more surprisingly, however, Mark seems to have escaped the media glare that has focused on other Epstein associates. And there has been no indication of him being investigated officially for his links to Epstein. This is surprising, because as we shall see, there is plenty of evidence revealing extensive business connections between the two brothers, as well as links to the seedier side of Epstein's operation. Mark grew up alongside his elder brother in Brooklyn, and attended the Cooper Union School of Art in Manhattan and Stony Brook University. According to The Daily Beast, neighbors described the young Mark, nicknamed Puggy, as a talented artist with a good business brain. This led him to set up an early artistic business venture, silkscreening T-shirts, that was described as one of the most versatile silkscreening printing companies in New York, according to Business Insider. In the 80s, Mark headed a charter and leasing company called Atelier Enterprises before moving into real estate investment in the 90s. More worryingly, given his connections to his brother, he opened a modeling agency in 2005 called Saint Model and Talent. But according to Business Insider, the company has no website or social media presence and has never signed a model. Despite his checkered list of accomplishments, Mark somehow earned enough money to semi-retire at the age of 39, whilst donating hundreds of thousands of dollars to charities. Perhaps that had something to do with a trait he shared with his brother, a readiness to bend the rules when it came to financial dealings. In 2002, he was named chairman of the board of trustees at his alma mater, Cooper Union, but in 2015 was forced to step down amidst claims of financial mismanagement. Another similarity to his brother is the ease with which he moved in political circles. Mark is listed on the board of directors for the Humpty Dumpty Institute, an organization which works with the UN to help young people from developing countries, another alarm bell given his brother's child trafficking operation. According to the Daily Beast, Mark loaned the Institute $100,000 in 2014 and led a delegation of Republican and Democratic representatives to an event organized by the Institute in Belgium in April 2019. But it is through his real estate dealings that Mark's ties to Epstein become more apparent. The brothers' joint venture into property started early, according to the book Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales, in which a childhood friend of Epstein's told the authors that Jeffrey started buying property in Manhattan early on. Epstein's classmate, Gary Grossberg, told the authors, "He started buying properties in Manhattan, including 301 East 66th Street. He asked his brother, did Mark want to join him? He did." Mark's real estate company, Ossa Properties, owned as many as 500 rental apartments around New York in the 90s, according to a New York Times report, and was run by a man called Anthony Barrett, a former asset manager for brother Jeffrey. Ossa Properties also owned most of the apartments in the 301 East 66th Street building that was at the center of Epstein's child trafficking operation. Mark told Cranes New York that he bought the unit in the early 90s from, guess who? That's right, Leslie Wexner. Two of Epstein's companies were officially registered at the building, and he used it to house his employees, including house managers and pilots. Epstein's long-term lawyer, Darren Indyke, also used the building as the primary address for his law firm, DKI PLLC. At one point, Jean-Luc Brunel had an apartment in the building, and Epstein's ex-girlfriend, Eva Anderson, who later married Glenn Dubin, also lived there. But it also saw the seedier side of Epstein's operation. Underage models from Brunel's MC2 modelling agency were housed there, after having been trafficked from various parts of the world. Former MC2 bookkeeper Maritza Vasquez swore under oath that girls were staying in Epstein's rooms in the building with up to 4 girls per apartment. The building was also home to 4 of Epstein's chief procurers, Nadia Masinkova, Sarah Kellen, Adriana Ross, and Leslie Groff. Indeed, Masinkova's aviation marketing company, Aviloop, and Kellen's design company, SLK Designs, were both registered at the 66th Street address until recently. One of the 66th Street units, previously registered to Masinkova, is now the business address of Joyce Anderson, a fashion photographer who specializes in children and pre-teens, according to her website. Worrying? Perhaps. Especially when you discover that Anderson is Mark Epstein's ex-wife and mother of his 2 children. According to Business Insider, Anderson's photography business had previously been based at 30 Van Damme Street, another building owned by Mark Epstein, where the mysterious Saint Models and Talent Agency was based. As we have already seen, ex-Israeli Prime Minister and Epstein associate, Ehud Barak, was often seen visiting the building, usually with a security detail waiting outside, which sometimes included New York police officers. One witness described seeing Barak pay a visit to the building as late as 2019. One can only guess as to the former spyhead's purposes, but the large number of young girls that were housed there might provide a clue. Mark Epstein has denied knowing what went on in the 66th Street building, but given the multiple links illustrated, it stretches credibility to breaking point that he wouldn't have some idea of what was happening at a property he largely owned. It's also baffling why he hasn't been the subject of a serious investigation, given his multiple connections to his brother's operation. Nicole Junkerman. Nicole Junkerman is not a name you will often see associated with Jeffrey Epstein. The German-born investor and entrepreneur is often touted as one of the most prominent women in tech finance. A former model who speaks 5 languages, the statuesque blonde Junkerman looks like the perfect role model for women entrepreneurs around the globe. However, behind the glittery facade, there lies some very shady connections, which have been largely wiped from the internet. Connections which link her to Epstein and Israeli intelligence, and which cast suspicion over her current role, gathering patient data for the NHS. What we know of the darker side of Junkerman is largely thanks to one researcher and independent investigative journalist, Johnny Vedmore. Vedmore has been researching the shadier side of Junkerman's dealings for several years and has found some intriguing connections to Epstein and the underground circles he moved in. Junkerman's first entrepreneurial role came in 1998, immediately after graduating in business administration from the International University of Monaco, when she co-founded Winamax, an early online gaming platform. In 2001, Winamax was sold and Junkerman invested in Infront Sports and Media AG, where she went on to become vice chairman of the board of directors. Despite being a relatively unknown company, Infront Sports and Media won the TV rights to the 2006 FIFA World Cup in Germany. This was an interesting decision by FIFA, as its president, Sepp Blatter, is the uncle of Infront's chairman and CEO, Philippe Blatter. At around this time, Junkerman also graduated from Harvard's prestigious Program for Management Development. At the same time, Epstein was heavily involved in funding the university, and Vedmore speculates as to whether this might be where the two first met. it is quite possible that Epstein was using his Harvard links to scout for talent to recruit to his intelligence operation, and Yonkerman would certainly have fitted the bill. Yonkerman's stunning good looks would also have drawn the attention of a man who was known for his predilection for leggy blondes. However they met, the two clearly knew each other, because around this time, Yonkerman flew on the Lolita Express 3 times. On the first occasion, she was joined by 2 other guests. But on the second and third trips, intriguingly, she and Epstein flew alone. These flights were part of a 3-day trip to England, which Vedmore has researched in depth and dug up some fascinating information on. On Saturday, August the 31st, 2002, Epstein and Yonkerman flew from Paris to Birmingham. From there, as Vedmore discovered from an inside source, a private helicopter picked them up and flew them 25 miles south to the stunning 18th-century manor Foxcote House in Warwickshire. Foxcote House is of particular interest because it belonged to none other than Leslie Wexner, who bought the property in 1997 for around £3 million. According to Vedmore's insider, the Wexners weren't in residence on the weekend Epstein and Yonkerman visited, but a couple of notable guests were. 2 serving members of the United States Senate, no less. Vedmore's insider didn't provide the names of these 2 senators, but did mention that they had trouble with the estate's internet connection, which necessitated calling in an engineer to fix the problem. The source also said that security for the meeting was mostly provided by off-duty British police. On Sunday, the small group went hunting, and that evening, Epstein turned up to dinner with 2 stunning women, a brunette on one arm and a blonde on the other. The blonde was Yonkerman, but the brunette's identity is unknown. It could have been Epstein's assistant, Sarah Kellen, who was listed on the return flight from Paris to New York. Or it could have been a young girl called Cindy Lopez, who was logged multiple times on the Lolita Express and was also listed on the return flight to New York. Cindy Lopez was a model for Jean-Luc Brunel's Carin modelling agency, and was photographed arm-in-arm with Bill Clinton on the Lolita Express on a separate occasion. It is unclear what was discussed over the weekend at Foxcote House, but the timing, the location, and the presence of 2 sitting senators provide some important clues. September 2002 was 1 year after 9/11, and just 1 month before the joint resolution was passed, which paved the way for the invasion of Iraq. As we've already seen, Wexner was pushing for such an invasion in the interests of Israel, and had even published a document on how to win the propaganda battle in supporting the war. Given Wexner's involvement in promoting the invasion of Iraq, and the fact that the meeting was arranged at a Wexner property, Vedmore makes the reasonable speculation that Epstein was there to lobby the senators on behalf of his master, Wexner. As to the identity of the senators, Vedmore believes he has narrowed it down to 5, based on personal donations given by the Wexners between 2000 and 2004. Of these 5, the 2 closest donations to the Foxcote House meeting were paid to Montana Democrat Max Baucus and Ohio Republican George Voinovich. Vedmore also notes that Abigail Wexner donated $5,000 to the Ohio Democratic Party on August the 31st, 2002, the first night of the Foxcote House meeting. Could this have been an expenses payment for the trip? Vedmore's other guess is that one of the senators was John Kerry. At the time, Senator Kerry was a prime contender to challenge George Bush in the 2004 election. Kerry was a keen huntsman, and Epstein had been courting the contender for some time. with several donations between 1991 and 2002. Kerry's name also appears in the Little Black Book, and it is reasonable to suggest that Epstein was grooming Kerry to be his next Clinton, an American Democratic president who owed him favours. Whatever was decided at the meeting, the group disbanded on Monday, September the 2nd. Epstein and Youngerman flew back to Paris, where they went their separate ways. And Epstein took the Lolita Express back to New York, accompanied by Jean-Luc Brunel, Sarah Kellen, and Cindy Lopez. It was the last recorded time that Youngerman flew on Epstein's plane, but their links didn't end there. Youngerman went on to found and invest in many other tech startups, one of which was Carbine 911. As we've already heard, Epstein was a major funder of the company, and Carbine 911's list of directors and investors reads like a who's who of Israeli intelligence operatives. Youngerman became a director of the firm alongside former Israeli Prime Minister and head of intelligence, Ehud Barak, who is a long-time Epstein associate and probable fellow paedophile. According to Vedmore, negative content about Youngerman has readily disappeared from the internet. As part of this purge, her picture has been removed from Carbine's board of directors. Perhaps a wise move, as her links to Israeli intelligence don't particularly square well with her current role gathering data on NHS patients. In 2018, UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock appointed Youngerman to the NHS's Health Tech Advisory Board, which is tasked with providing technological solutions to improve patient outcomes and reducing the workload on NHS staff. Apart from her prominent position on the Health Tech Advisory Board, Youngerman is an investor in Owkin, an AI startup that uses machine learning to augment medical and biology research. In 2019, Owkin announced that London hospitals had promised the company patients' data in order to develop better drugs. Should the NHS be handing over UK citizens' private medical data to a firm with such clear links to a foreign intelligence agency? Probably not. But that's what it seems is about to happen. Epstein must be laughing in his grave. Mohammed bin Salman. Epstein's relations with foreign heads of state weren't limited to Israel's, it seems. He was also, according to his own testimony, good friends with Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. As we have heard, when the New York Times journalist Edward J. Epstein interviewed Jeffrey Epstein in his 71st Street mansion, he noticed a photo of Mohammed bin Salman. When questioned about the relationship, Epstein told him he was close friends with the heir to the Saudi throne and often played host to him. Epstein also mentioned that he wanted to buy a house in Riyadh, as he thought it would soon become one of the financial centres of the world. Epstein was fond of playing up his relationships with famous people, and he wasn't averse to downright lying. But other evidence points to the relationship being real. As well as the photo, bin Salman, or MBS as he's often known, appeared in the Little Black Book. And when the police raided Epstein's Manhattan home, they found a fake Austrian passport that contained several stamps for Saudi Arabia. The passport also listed Saudi as Epstein's official place of residence. Even more intriguing, flight data reveals that Epstein's plane flew into Riyadh on November the 7th, 2016, the eve of the US election, which would see Trump come to power. It is not known what Epstein was doing in Riyadh for the 48 hours he stayed there. But Mohammed bin Salman was also there at the time. According to Insider, the Saudi press agency reported that MBS was in Riyadh on November the 8th to present a Distinguished Service Award to General Joseph F. Dunford, Jr., Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. Another important figure who happened to be in Riyadh at the time was Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon. Bezos had a meeting with MBS on November the 9th to discuss, according to the Saudi press agency, fields of cooperation and investment opportunities available according to the Kingdom's Vision 2030. Could it be that Epstein met with both MBS and Bezos at some point during his 48-hour stay? We already know of his connections to the Crown Prince, and Epstein also knew Bezos, at least in passing. They had met twice before at meetings hosted by the Edge Foundation in 2004 and 2011. There is no official record of the three men meeting in Riyadh, but given the timing and the fact that they all knew each other, it seems likely that some kind of get-together was arranged. Interestingly, perhaps taking a leaf out of Epstein's book, MBS tried to blackmail Bezos at a later date. The incident concerned the murder of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who had written several articles critical of Saudi Arabia and bin Salman for The Washington Post, a paper owned by Bezos. On October the 2nd, 2018, Khashoggi was murdered, horrifically, at the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. Despite official denials, it is widely believed that the Saudi regime, and specifically bin Salman, were behind the murder. Following Khashoggi's death, the Washington Post ramped up its criticism of the Saudi regime and bin Salman, linking them to the murder. In April 2018, bin Salman attended a small dinner with Bezos, and the two exchanged WhatsApp numbers. On May the 1st, MBS sent Bezos a video file, which, according to a later UN investigation, infected Bezos's phone with malicious code. Then in January 2019, the National Enquirer ran a scoop about Bezos having an extramarital affair. The National Enquirer's parent company, American Media Inc., had been investigated before for links to the Saudi regime, and bin Salman, and American Media CEO David Pecker also had a close relationship. It seems reasonable, therefore, to assume that the National Enquirer's source for the story had been Bezos's hacked phone. Back in 2016, when the meeting between Epstein, MBS and Bezos might have taken place, Khashoggi was already under suspicion by the Saudi government. And indeed, later that year, he was banned from appearing in Saudi publications and on Saudi TV. This ban was officially for criticizing US President-elect Donald Trump, although it was probably more likely connected to Khashoggi's increasingly disaffection with the Saudi government. Could the meeting between MBS, Epstein and Bezos have been about Khashoggi? Or at least touched on him at some point? It's interesting to note that Jamal Khashoggi was the nephew of Saudi arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi, who, as we have seen, worked closely with Epstein throughout the 80s. Could Bezos and Epstein have persuaded bin Salman to let Khashoggi out of the country, thus securing his relocation to the US in June the following year? As with much of Epstein's clandestine dealings, we may never know. One thing seems sure, though. Epstein had ties to the highest levels of the Saudi regime, and given similar connections to Israel and the US, and his involvement with international arms trading and child trafficking, any number of worrying transactions could have taken place between him and bin Salman. John Brockman. John Brockman is a writer and literary agent for many of the world's top science writers. He created the Edge Foundation to bring together top thinkers in their scientific fields to share knowledge and catalyze new ideas. He is, above everything else, a networker, a super connector of the world's most interesting minds. We met him briefly in an earlier chapter when he seemed to have played a role in Epstein's post-2010 rehabilitation as a patron of science and technology. One of Brockman's clients, technology writer Yevgeny Morozov, described Brockman at the time as a kind of PR agent for Epstein, connecting him with various scientists to add to Epstein's own, more sordid network. But why was Brockman doing this? And how deep did the relationship go? As far as motives go, we don't have to look much further than the money. Morozov found that Epstein had funded Brockman's Edge Foundation to the tune of $638,000 between 2001 and 2015. Epstein donated at least $50,000 a year in 2009, 2010, and 2011, according to BuzzFeed News, at just the time when his reputation most needed laundering. In many years, Epstein was the Edge Foundation's sole donor, and it seemed that it was his money that paid for the organization's billionaires' dinners, star-studded events linked to TED Talks where science and tech gurus would schmooze and exchange ideas. Indeed, after Epstein's last donation of $30,000 in 2015, the billionaires' dinners promptly stopped. Epstein himself attended many of the Edge Foundation events, like the 2011 Billionaires' Dinner at Long Beach, California, alongside Jeff Bezos, Sergey Brin, and Elon Musk. So too did one of Epstein's procurers, Sarah Kellen. Kellen was photographed at the 2002 Billionaires' Dinner with Brockman, and at the 2003 event with Brockman's son, Max. Brockman and his wife flew to the 2002 event on the Lolita Express with Epstein and his entourage, in addition to several famous scientists, including Richard Dawkins and Steven Pinker. But Brockman's science connections weren't only established through the Edge Foundation. His literary agency, Brockman Inc., has signed some of the best scientific minds in the world, clients who all too often had links to Epstein as well. Marvin Minsky, who Virginia Giuffre claims she was forced to have sex with, was a client of Brockman. Joy Ito, who, as we have heard, was accepting large donations from Epstein for the MIT Media Lab, was also a Brockman client. And Steven Pinker and Danielle Dennett, who both have associations with Epstein, are Brockman's clients too. Brockman and Epstein's association appears to go back to at least 1991. In that year, Brockman wrote a massively influential essay entitled The Third Culture for the science magazine Seed. Epstein was, according to court documents, a board member of Seed's parent company, Seed Media Group, at the time. But it was after Epstein's release from his Florida sentence that the relationship went into overdrive. Brockman appeared to go out of his way to connect Epstein with scientists and technologists from his circle. One example comes from Morozov, who was one of Brockman Inc.'s clients at the time. Morozov related in an article in the New Republic in 2019 how Brockman had emailed him in 2013 saying of Epstein, "He'll be in Cambridge in a couple of weeks. Ask me who he should meet. You were one of the people I suggested, and told him I would send some links." In the email, Brockman made it clear that he knew about Epstein's crimes, saying, "He also got into trouble and spent a year in jail in Florida." Brockman also mentioned Epstein's predilection for traveling with beautiful young assistants, saying, "Jeffrey Epstein, the billionaire science philanthropist, showed up at this weekend's event by helicopter with his beautiful young assistant from Belarus." Brockman went on to recount an anecdote about a meeting with Epstein in his New York mansion. The story is extremely revealing, not only about Brockman and Epstein's relationship, but also about Prince Andrew's final visit to Epstein in New York. Brockman wrote, "Last time I visited his house, the largest private residence in New York City. I walked in to find him in a sweatsuit, and a British guy in a suit with suspenders getting foot massages from two young, well-dressed Russian women. After grilling me for a while about cybersecurity, the Brit named Andy was commenting on the Swedish authorities and the charges against Julian Assange. "We think they're liberal in Sweden, but it's more like Northern England as opposed to Southern Europe," he said. "In Monaco, Albert works 12 hours a day, but at 9 p.m, when he goes out, he does whatever he wants, and nobody cares. But if I do it, I'm in big trouble." At that point, I realized that the recipient of Irene's foot massage was His Royal Highness Prince Andrew, the Duke of York. Indeed, a week later, on a slow news day, the cover of the New York Post had a full page of Jeffrey and Andrew walking in Central Park under the headline, "The Prince and the Perv." That was the end of Andrew's role as the UK trade ambassador. After illustrating Brockman and Epstein's close relationship, this cast intriguing light on what Andrew was doing at Epstein's 71st Street mansion. If we remember from earlier, in Andrew's car crash BBC Newsnight interview, the Prince told the interviewer, Emily Maitlis, that although he did stay at Epstein's New York mansion in 2010, he had hardly seen Epstein, except at a brief dinner party and in passing in the corridor. Brockman's email not only contradicts that claim. Having a foot massage along Epstein is hardly passing in the corridor, but also throws into question Andrew's activities during a trip which was supposed to act as an end to their friendship. If Andrew was receiving foot massages from young Russian girls when guests like Brockman were present, what was he doing with them when they were alone? Given Brockman's close links to Epstein and his fervent attempts to network on the paedophile's behalf, as well as the photographs showing him alongside Epstein assistants, it is tempting to ask whether Epstein had something over Brockman other than just the funding. Was Brockman one of the many victims of Epstein's sexual blackmail operation? Brockman has so far refused to comment on his ties to Epstein. No evidence of any sexual misconduct on Brockman's part has yet come to light, and there is still a lot of information to come out, and some of that may stay forever hidden. As with many of Epstein's associates, we may never know the truth, but it would certainly explain the fervor with which Brockman was promoting Epstein, a convicted paedophile, within his circle of high-profile scientists.